And welcome back to Cool Science Radio. Now Henry Timms joins us. Henry's the president of the Lincoln Center for the Performing Arts in New York City. Formerly, he was the president and CEO of the 92nd Street Y, a cultural and community center that creates programs and movements that foster learning and civic engagement. Under his leadership, the 144-year-old institution was named to Fast Company's Most Innovative Companies list. This is an important point because Henry will be taking us through a concept of new power, which is also the name of his new book he's co-written with Jeremy Hymans. How has Henry applied the lessons of new power to a well-established company? Well, Henry will tell us all about it and how new power is reshaping politics, business, and life to be more open, participatory, and peer-driven. Henry Timms, welcome to Cool Science Radio.
What a pleasure to be joining you today.
Well, it's a pleasure to have you. You know, we all sense there's something going on with power. It's shifting. We don't really understand it, but, you know, the upstart businesses upending traditional industries like Airbnb and Uber, the Me Too movement toppling the once untouchable, all of these things are sort of in the mix. Maybe you can start by just giving us a basic definition of the difference between old power and new power.
Sure. So if you think about the way that we all thought about power for a long time and the way a lot of people got a lot of things done, it was very kind of command and control. It was all about the leaders. It was about people kind of downloading their ideas onto the world and doing things on their terms. You think about Harvey Weinstein as a figure, the way he used his power. It was all about what he controlled, what he could start, what he could stop. You know, he literally controlled a whole industry because he had all this power, which he had as a kind of currency that he owned and nobody else did. What's so interesting about our world today, with everyone being so hyper-connected, is we're seeing this emergence of what we call new power. And new power works very differently. So new power is made by many people. It's about people uploading their own ideas. It's a much more distributed, much less controlled model. So think for a moment about the Me Too movement. The Me Too movement is a great example of new power. It wasn't about one individual or one leader. It was about women all around the world adding their voices to a collective movement that surged around the world and had huge amounts of impact on countries and societies and organizations around the world. So the work we've done for the book New Power really starts to say, how do each of us understand what this new power is? This force that you arguably got both Donald Trump and Barack Obama into office, this force that high school kids are using to organize global protests around gun rights, this force that entrepreneurs are using to create platforms like Facebook and Uber. The story of our times is who can get their hands around this connected crowd and get them to do their bidding. And so what we do in the book is lay out practical tools for everybody to start thinking about how you learn these new power skills.
And interestingly, in your book, you say that Barack Obama uses new power to get elected, but once he's in office, it's the same old, you know, he goes back to the old ways. Can you talk about that?
Yeah, I think one of the great achievements of the Obama era was the way that they campaigned using new power. We remember, you know, we are the change we are waiting for, the kind of very grassroots distributed campaign that got Obama, who at that point was an unlikely outsider figure, but got him into the White House, really showed this kind of instinctive understanding of how you could use new power to surge up into a campaign. But then once Obama got into office, one of the criticisms, I think, of his tenure was that all of that new power he used to get elected actually didn't help him govern. So he wasn't able to draw on those crowds on an ongoing basis in favor of his policy outcomes. It's actually very different than Donald Trump. So what Donald Trump has done is use that same new power to get into office. So much of his campaign was supercharged by the kind of intensity that he built on social media, that platforms like Reddit and others would get behind ideas. They would create their own ideas around his campaign and what it should be. So it was a very kind of new power campaign. But what Donald Trump has also done is continue to rely upon new power in office as he thinks about how he governs. So much of it is about this ongoing call and response with this kind of social media army who helps strengthen his presidency even in the way that it puts pressure on the traditional power structures. So the lesson here, no matter what your politics are, is people often good at campaigning with new power, but actually don't institutionalize that. And one of the great skills for any business or nonprofit or academic institution is how do you use nonprofit in an everyday basis? How do you use new power on an everyday basis?
You spoke a moment ago about the protests surrounding gun rights as being part of new power, and yet nothing has changed, at least in this country. Laws around gun rights haven't really changed. So is there something that those protests brought about by this new power are lacking, are not following through, just as you say Obama didn't follow through with this new application of power?
Yeah, so in a way, I think one of the things that is interesting to think about is how effective the NRA has been, because they have a good old power strategy and a good new power strategy. And the argument we make in the book is that it's not, you know, one or the other. The organizations who do really well have worked out how to use old power and new power. So the NRA have this great old power strategy. It's very feared as a brand. Politicians don't want to get the wrong side of the NRA. The NRA literally gives politicians their grades for how well those politicians are behaving. So it's a very old power mindset, and it's a very effective one. But what the NRA also has done over years is built this ecosystem of grassroots activists and communities around the country who they've invested in small ways, often gun clubs, local associations, and that community feels very tied to the NRA's mission and not necessarily their brand. So what ends up happening in these moments where the gun control debate flares up, often what you'll see is the gun rights side of the lobby actually out-dialing, out-phoning, out-mobilizing those in favor of gun control, because new power comes in to back up the old power of the NRA. What we saw with the Parkland kids, I think, perhaps was a very positive sign for those in favor of sensible gun control in this country, was we saw this real emergence of a new power wing for the gun control movement. So they really showed how this kind of distributed pressure could lead somewhere interesting. And my prediction would be, and my hope would be, that that's the beginning of a new wave of mobilization around gun control, which will lead to some outcomes in this country which will be less predictable than those in the past.
Mm. If you're just joining us, our guest is Henry Timms. His book that he has co-written is called New Power, How Power Works in Our Hyper-Connected World and How to Make It Work for You. So, Henry, you certainly have made it work for you in the organization that you've been involved with. You were the president and CEO of the 92nd Street Y. And under your leadership, this very old institution was named Fast Company's Most Innovative Companies list, which I find fascinating. Can you tell us the story of how it got to Fast Company's list?
Well, I think what we've been doing, so the 92nd Street Y, I'm still in this role for another 3 weeks. I start at Lincoln Center at the beginning of May. So it's nice to talk about the 92nd Street Y as I come to the end of my time here. We're a 145-year-old cultural and community center in New York, and we run programs that will be very familiar to lots of your listeners. We have arts programs, we have a senior center, we have educational programs, we have concerts, we have talk series, we have poetry. So it's really kind of bustling cultural and community center. And, you know, for 145 years, we had a pretty old power model. So people would come to our venue and we would provide them with services. And that is how we work. What we've been trying to do in the last 5 years or so is ask ourselves, if the mission of the institution is around bringing people together and creating communities and connections, how do we use some of these new tools in the world to create connections in new ways? And so we've come up with lots of new projects to do that, and I'll give you a couple of examples. One is a project called Giving Tuesday. So after Black Friday and Cyber Monday, we said, shouldn't there be a Giving Tuesday, a day where instead of people buying things for themselves, we get people to give to each other? And Giving Tuesday was designed in a very new power way. We didn't brand it as like the 92nd Street Wise Giving Tuesday. We took our brand off that project. We encouraged people to turn it into whatever they wanted to turn it into. We didn't say there's one way of doing this and you must do it our way. We said, be creative with this, turn it into something special. And because we did that, it really has then surged around the country and around the world. And Giving Tuesday now has raised over $1 billion online in small gifts. But it's also now in 100 countries around the world. And it's everything from people teaching lessons to school kids about kindness to people giving blood in Barbados. So it's become this global celebration of generosity. And it couldn't be more at the mission of the why, right? It's just a very different way of thinking about how we meet our mission, which isn't just the kind of local old power way we always have, but using these new technologies to connect in new ways. And another project which your listeners might find interesting is called the Ben Franklin Circles. So Ben Franklin used to have this wonderful club. He would get together every week or so with a group of friends, and they would talk about how to improve themselves and how to improve the world. So it was like a book club for a better world with no books. And we worked to bring that back after hundreds of years in abeyance and get people to start hosting these circles around the country. But rather than just say, come to our circle at the Y, we created toolkits and opportunities for people to engage so people all over the country can create their own Ben Franklin circles and invite people to get with them and engage and discuss these. So now in we have 350 of these going across the U.S. in 30 different states, where groups of veterans, local police organizations, groups of seniors are getting together on a monthly basis to talk about how to live fuller and more virtuous lives. And again, it's a long way from the New York City old power model that we thrived on, but what we're trying to do is work out how to reimagine our model for a new generation.
So it used to be that the smartest person in the room was the smartest person in the room, and now it seems like it's the crowd is the smartest person in the room. Is this one of the fundamental rules of new power? Going back to your example of Giving Tuesday, is not to have rules and let people figure it out for themselves?
I think it's not about people not having rules. It's about thinking about a different kind of leadership. So often the projects I've mentioned, and in fact any of the successful new power projects, aren't things that are completely chaotic and anarchic. They're things that give people a lot more ownership and agency, but they're often actually very well and very carefully designed. So what you're not saying is just open up and give all the control over to the crowd and see what happens. What you're trying to do is set a context for people to engage in meaningful ways, but also to shape that in the direction that you want it to go. So if you think about, for example, the Me Too movement, you know, that was an extraordinary thing, but it clearly had a direction that was shaping around the world in powerful ways. It wasn't chaos, it wasn't anarchy. It had a very clear narrative. It was really going in a very powerful direction, and it basically stayed on track, right? It wasn't as if it went out of control in terms of its original purpose. So I think you can see these things in that way, and I think the leadership implication of this is we have to stop looking for superstar leaders and start looking for kind of superconductor leaders. Mm. So the era of like the brilliant individual whose personal insight and journey will solve everyone's problem, I think that leadership model looks very dated. The leaders who I most admire right now are those people who actually aren't the stars of the show, but what they're very good at is actually connecting other people, collaborating effectively, bringing people together. So all of the people who are running these Ben Franklin circles around the country, they're all people who are working out really careful ways how to make other people feel more powerful. And that's the great new power leadership skill.
And in this new world, there are a number of examples of, and your book has a lot of information in it about how these companies came together. And in talking about Reddit and Uber, what went wrong with them? Where did they move away from understanding the power?
Well, I think Uber's a really interesting example because they did such an amazing job of using new power in technological terms, right? If you think about how quickly they scaled this global network of drivers and riders in a way which is a completely participatory new power model, very unlike the old power taxi model that we knew. The challenge with Uber is that they did this, that they got the technology piece right, but actually the culture of the company was really at odds with the crowd that it was trying to build. So Uber, whenever they wanted to change their fares, they wouldn't engage their drivers in that conversation. They just send everyone a text saying it's Friday night and the fares are changing. So they built this crowd without actually building any kind of community around it. And so one of the things we talk about in the book is if you're going to build these new power models, you have to also have new power values. You have to work out how you actually can be more meaningfully connected with the crowd. And in the case of Uber, it's really interesting that Lyft, who, of course, just IPO'd, Lyft are really trying to make a statement about culture. They're trying to say that we actually, as an organization, have a social purpose. We're good to our drivers. We're good to our riders. We're building something here which honors the crowd we are built on. So for any of these big platform companies, there's a real question about, can you get your values and your models aligned? And I think Uber over recent years has really struggled with that. And I think the new leadership is trying to get that right.
It's so interesting, this story of Lyft and Uber, because in our community and in many towns and cities across the country, there's been a real issue with being able to regulate those disruptive technologies like Lyft and Uber. And what we see here in Park City, from my understanding, during the Sundance Film Festival, Lyft is willing to work with the community to say, hey, what's going to work best for you? Still, the taxi drivers don't like them, of course, but Lyft is the one that's willing to participate, and Uber, you know, hasn't shown up in that way. Lyft becomes the winner. So very interesting, and I'm starting to understand why as you talk through this.
Well, an interesting question with Lyft and Uber is ultimately the model is what counts, right? So if you either you can provide a ride within 3 minutes or you can't. And if Uber's 3 minutes and Lyft is 7 minutes, then Uber's going to win time and time again. But if they're both offering 3 minute rides and one company makes you feel like you're part of something purposeful and you're connected to your community and that they're listening to you, and the other makes you feel like you're just part of a machine, it's pretty easy to see which technology people are going to choose. So I think the lesson in all this is, how do you not just scale your technology, but how do you build a more human culture around the technology as you build it, which is something more than once in a while claiming to be a good corporate citizen, because people just don't believe that anymore.
Right. So the term disruptive technology and the term new power have obvious similarities, but I'm wondering how much more you have to define with new power that leaves out some of the definition of a disruptive technology.
Well, I think the danger with the conversation about disruptive technology is it focuses on the technology. And actually that, of course, is changing in ways we can all recognize. But what's really changing is the human piece of this. So it's the expectation people have of how they participate in the world that people really have to reckon with. It's not just, do you understand, you know, the blockchain, or have you finally joined Twitter? It's actually a conversation about all this participatory nature in the world, all these technologies that surround us and younger people in the world. What is changing about how they expect to engage, and how do we as organizations engage with that? So I'll give you an example. 50% of people now are having a two-screen experience when watching television. So they're not just involved in the old power version, which was TV broadcast at you. They've also got a device in their hand, and they're trying to engage with the world in interesting ways. So what is that appetite for engagement? If you look at the arts, of course, which is something I've spent a lot of my career in, if you look at the arts, the one art form that's really growing is outdoor music festivals. One of the reasons for that is people feel like it's a real experience. They can get their phones out. They can kind of shape the experience in their terms. And as you look around the world, what you'll see time and time again is the people who are getting ahead right now aren't just the people who understand technologies, but they understand this increasing desire for people to participate and to do more than simply consume. So that becomes the big question, I think, which is what new power is all about, is, are you thinking about how to make people feel more powerful? Are you giving people more interesting roles to play? Because the generation of people who were used to kind of waiting in line and taking their turns and, you know, waiting 15 years for their promotion, that generation just is not, that the philosophy of that generation just doesn't hold up in a world where every 17-year-old is a painter, an activist, a filmmaker, an investor, an entrepreneur. Mm-hmm. We have this amazing generation of people who expect the world to be shaped on their terms, and we can either roll our eyes at those people, which is, I think, what a lot of people have done, or we can say, how do we get them to engage in meaningful ways? And that's certainly been the posture of the 92nd Street Y.
Well, this is all very refreshing, but what are some of the challenges in the new power model?
I think there are lots. So one of them is new power can surge up and then disappear quite quickly. So we, you know, it's interesting that the three biggest protests in U.S. history have been in the last 3 years. So these huge surges of new power, and they can surge up and then they can disappear. Many people, you know, after the Women's March were disappointed, I think, that that had been such a moment of kind of new power and energy, and that it didn't really translate into some of the changes people had hoped for. So new power can be quite fickle in that sense, but I think that's a danger in general. And the second thing with new power is it right now, and I think this is why it's particularly important for the types of people who are listening to this program, the people who have got good at this typically aren't the people who have been the kind of civic-minded bastions of society in the past. So you look at how good, for example, climate deniers are at new power, or you look at the anti-vaxxer movement right now is surging around the country, who have really worked out how to use new power to get outcomes. And, you know, the medical professionals who have all the facts in the world and all the evidence and all the white papers, if that's all they're communicating with, their message just isn't getting across. So one of the dangers with new power now is actually the people who the listeners of this program would most like to be shaping society are often the people who are worst at new power, because they were used to a world where they were the experts, everyone listened to them, they could issue their decrees and the world would change. And that mindset just isn't cutting through today. So I think one of the challenges, one of the reasons we wrote the book, was to say we want those people who are running institutions, the teachers, the academics, the scientists, the politicians, the local legislators, the people who are in charge of building a more civic world, those people need their old power more than ever, but they also have to build a set of new power skills, which we lay out in the book.
Henry, I'm wondering if we might be experiencing some viral fatigue, where maybe a couple of years ago when something went viral, we all kind of knew about it, and now things go viral on a pretty regular basis, and you can't keep up with everything.
I don't think it's just viral fatigue. I think it's social fatigue, right? I think one of the great dangers of our age is we've never been more connected in terms of technology, but actually for all the connectedness, people feel disconnected. You know, isolation is on the rise. Anxiety is on the rise. People are feeling like life is not having the kind of meaning it used to. So there's this weird paradigm right now where we're deluged with all this information and all of this chaos, and it actually isn't leading for people to live full lives, which is one of the reasons that, you know, things like the cultural world matter so much. One of the reasons that the arts matter so much now is the arts is one of those ways which really helps us find again the kind of most human part of us. It's one of the ways that we understand ourselves and we understand other people. And I think we have all got quite tired of this diet of constant kind of fear and dopamine and extremism that the digital world has created around us. And what I think I'm beginning to see is people pushing back against that and actually trying to reclaim some of the more meaningful parts of our lives that the digital world has distracted us from.
Mm. Henry, something you were talking about a few moments ago made me think about your example in the book of Nike ID and talking about how Nike's sales have increased or such a big share of their sales is with shoes that the consumer participates in by designing the colors, for example. Tell us about that example. It's a nice one, and I've had a few friends get those shoes and design them on their own, and they just love them.
Oh, well, that's a great example. So I think that kind of speaks to this, the age of participation that people expect to do more than simply consume. Nike ID is a shoe line that Nike has where you can basically design your own shoe and add your own flavor. And if you think about the one thing that makes the big social media technologies of our age work, it's because you get to add your own stamp. You get to make it about you, right? If you think, remember the ice bucket challenge, that worked because it wasn't about you watching somebody else's commercial. It was about you creating your own content and sharing it with your friends. And so I think the lesson for Nike ID is we all have to work out ways of inviting people to participate more in the things that we care about most. And whether you're a local church leader who is engaging with your congregation, or whether you're a local politician, if it's all about you and your ideas and your terms and people have limited roles, you're not going to get very far, very far. And actually, we saw that again with Nike. If you think about Nike and the Kaepernick commercial they did at the end of last year, you know, that commercial was a bold statement that they were making mm-hmm. around what was clearly a divisive issue, and they timed that right to the start of the Super Bowl season. And what they got so right about that campaign was it gave people something to participate in. They created a movement around their brand. So, you know, I remember speaking to a colleague who had taken her kids to the store to buy Nike shoes that weekend as a statement of solidarity alongside what they were doing to support Colin Kaepernick. So what they did so well there is they realized the key lesson of the new power age is the future is a battle for mobilization. Whoever mobilizes best wins. And the way you need to mobilize is to give people something to do and something to believe in. And the institutions of our world, the good, positive institutions of our world, are so used to being admired, and they're actually very bad, typically, about welcoming people to engage on their own terms.
Mm. Well, we've got just a minute left, but I have to ask you this quickly about what this new power could mean for women in leadership. You talked about how we're not looking for superstars, we're looking for super connectors. Women tend to be super connectors. And as we know, you know, when they talk about the traits of CEOs, as they have been, are very, oh, you know, sometimes psychopathic and very, all the words that go along with, or adjectives that go along to describe CEOs. But what does this mean for women?
Yeah. So I think one of the things, certainly if you look at the kind of the meta-analysis around women's leadership styles, there are certainly a number of areas which, and I think certainly I've observed this in all the work we've done around new power, the skills around collaboration, around empathy, around kind of co-ownership, those sets of skills are the skills that drive new power forward. And time and again, I think we've seen female leaders in particular who are very good at building those kinds of coalitions. But it's a very different kind of leadership, right? And the reason it's so effective is if it is the story of the kind of the superstar male leader taking up all the space with, you know, his 6'3" style and doing press-ups on the boardroom, like that cult of leadership doesn't leave room for other people to feel powerful. And the people who get new power so right are people who work out ways of being powerful through making other people powerful. There was a great example from the leaders of Black Lives Matter, I think are really the co-founders, of course, all women, who have such a powerful framing around this when they talk about